You're listening to After the Storm, where the healing begins on UK Health Radio. I'm Brian D. Smith, founder of Grief to Growth and a certified grief guide, life coach, and author. This part of my journey began after the passing of my 15-year-old daughter, Shayna. So I'm doing the work too. Each week, we explore the journey through grief, not just surviving loss, but discovering who you're becoming on the other side of it. This is where the healing begins. Somebody has told you that there are five stages of grief. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Now, they probably meant well, but they handed you a map to a country that you're not in. Today, I'm going to tell you where that map actually came from, who it was drawn for, and why it was never meant for you. Welcome to After the Storm. Last week, we talked about what actually changes on the Monday after everything falls apart. That gap between the crisis being over and life supposedly going back to normal. If you haven't heard that one yet, go back and listen after this, because today picks up right where that left off. Last week was about the disorientation of that first Monday. Today is about the false comfort people hand you in the weeks and months and years after that Monday. The idea that there's a tidy, predictable order to how you're supposed to feel from here. I'm here to tell you that there isn't, and I want to show you exactly why. In 1969, a psychiatrist named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross published a book called On Death and Dying. I read it decades ago. I think it was in high school. She spent years sitting with dying patients, people who knew their own death was coming, sometimes within weeks. She listened to how they talked about their deaths, and she noticed a pattern in how they related to their own mortality. A couple of things important to note here. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was studying dying people, not grieving people. The five stages describe how a person makes peace with their own upcoming death. It's not how a person survives losing someone else. Now, these things may be slightly related, but they're only related. They are certainly not the same. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross correctly never called them the five stages of grief. Somehow that label got bolted on by everyone who came after her, and that's a major mistake that we're going to talk about. But here's a question that's worth asking. If these five stages were never meant for grief in the first place, why won't this thing die? Why 50 plus years later are my clients still walking in the door telling me they're stuck on stage three or they skipped stage two? Well, I think it's because a wrong map still feels better than no map at all. Grief is one of the most disorienting things a human being will ever go through. You lose someone and the ground underneath your feet moves. It goes away. It drops out. You feel like you're in free fall. So when someone comes up and offers you, here, here's five neat steps with an ending. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. Done. Grief over. That's incredibly appealing. Well, it's not because it's true. It's because it's simple. And sometimes we prefer simple over true. Self-help culture likes a framework too. A tidy model sells. Here are the five things you'll feel in order is a much easier pitch than here's an unpredictable, looping, nonlinear process that might ambush you 11 years later. One of these fits on a poster. The other one is the truth. I was talking with a new client just a couple days ago on a discovery call, and she asked me what it might be like to work with me. I realized a while ago when I was going through grief coaching training and they were telling me to set up a program, a package that people can buy to make this easy and predictable and neat, and I even tried to do it, that there is no order. Everybody needs something different. I would be selling my clients short if I tried to sell them a package and say, in session one, we're going to do this. In session two, we're going to do this. In session eight, we're going to do this. And then you're done. I've seen a grief system, I'll call it, that promises you go through these 12 stages or these 12 episodes or these 12 sessions and you're done. I'm not buying that. It's not that people are foolish for believing in five stages. It's that we're wired to want a map or any map when the ground disappears beneath us. So now we all know about these five stages of grief, as we hear a lot about it now, but we've gotten it wrong in terms of the origins of it. So I want to clear that up. I want to also make it very clear that I'm not attacking Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in this episode at all. She herself pushed back on this later in her life. She said plainly that the stages were never meant to be linear, never meant to be universal, and never meant for grief itself. But somewhere between 1969 and now, that book became a checklist for the bereaved. Nobody voted on that. It just happened. In the way a rumor turns into fact if enough people repeat it. I remember after my daughter passed away, a well-meaning friend said, "Oh, it's too bad you and your wife are probably going to get divorced." I heard this myth that 65 or 70 or 80% of the people who lost a child get divorced. Turns out that's not true, but people believe it because it's been repeated so often. So my clients still come to me and they talk about the five stages of grief. They'll say, "You know, I thought I was over the anger and I was into the bargaining stage, but I find myself back in anger." And they're looking at this linear progression and you're thinking, that means I've got to go through the bargaining stage again. And if they get to whatever stage is supposed to be right before acceptance, stage four, and you go back to step one, you're repeating the whole process. That's not the way it works. So I want to make sure we give Elizabeth Kubler-Ross her due. She was doing something brave. She was sitting with dying people in 1969 when nobody talked about death at all. That took real courage, and her work helps a lot of people even to this day. And the misuse that came after that is not her fault. Kudos to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross for the work that she did. Here's how that mistake actually spread, though. And it's worth understanding because her book became required reading in nursing schools and medical training programs throughout the 70s and the 80s. It was taught to people who worked with the dying, which is exactly who it was written for. But over time, those five stages got pulled out of that specific context, and grief counselors, hospice workers, and eventually just regular people started applying it to anyone who had lost anyone in any circumstance. And by the time it reached pop culture, by the time it showed up in movies and daytime talk shows and self-help books, nobody was citing the original context anymore. It became, quote, common knowledge. Everyone just knew the five stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, without anybody remembering or ever having known that it started as an account of how dying patients related to their own mortality. That's how a specific, careful piece of research turns into a cultural myth. Not through one bad actor, through decades of well-meaning people, generation after generation, repeating something that sounded true until repetition did the work that evidence should have been doing. A dying person facing their own end and a person left standing after someone else's end are not doing the same work. One is preparing to leave. The other is learning how to stay. In this sense, they're almost the opposite. These are very different jobs, and they were never going to use the same instruction set. So this is really important because of this. When you hand someone the wrong map, they start using it to grade themselves. They say, "Wait a minute, I'm supposed to start with anger. I'm not feeling angry." Or, "I'm supposed to start with denial. I didn't start with denial. I skipped right on to anger." So people will tell me, "I have skipped this step," or, "I'm back in this step." And they'll say, "I thought I was over this like 8 months ago, and here I am again. And I've got to go all the way through it again. I was getting close to acceptance, and now I got to go back." And then they get upset with themselves, and they panic because it's not supposed to happen. Grief becomes a checklist that people fail instead of a process you can't really assign a form to. And nobody warned you this is happening. You just quietly start believing that you're grieving wrong. And so many people have told me, "I think I'm doing it wrong. I think I'm stuck. I'm not moving forward the way I'm supposed to." Now, there are common things that we see in grieving people, and we'll talk about those. And some of these grief models that I've studied as I've been doing my grief education, they're very useful in some senses. They're helpful as long as they are descriptive, not prescriptive. As long as they're not telling us what we're supposed to be going through or telling us what we're going to be going through, as long as they're describing where we happen to be and we're using them that way, they're fine. I want to tell you about a psychologist named George Bonanno. He's at Columbia, and he spent decades studying what actually happens to people after they lose someone. Not what we assume happens, but what the data actually shows. So before Bonanno, the dominant idea in the grief field, going back to Freud, was something called grief work. The theory was that to heal, you had to do painful psychological labor. You had to confront the loss head on, process it deeply, detach from the person bit by bit. But if you didn't do that work, the theory said, the grief would just go underground and come back to hurt you later. Bonanno went looking for evidence that this was true, and what he found instead surprised everybody, including him. He tells a story in his book, The Other Side of Sadness, about a mother who lost her daughter on 9/11. Years later, looking back, she said something that didn't fit the grief work model at all. She said that the loss had actually changed her for the better. Not that she wanted it, not that it was worth it. Nobody would say that. I want to say that again. When we talk about the resilience or the growth that can come out of grief, it doesn't mean that you wanted it. It doesn't mean that it was even worth it. But she said she saw people differently now. She treated people differently now. Now, if grief is a wound that you have to work through slowly before you're allowed to be okay again, that shouldn't happen. But Bonanno found that story over and over. And what he concluded was that human beings are, in his word, hardwired to handle loss, not by grinding through 5 sequential stages, but by using a much messier, more human toolkit. In a word, he found that humans are resilient. So many people have come to me and said, I could never go through what you've gone through. If I lost a child, I would lose my mind. They've gone to friends who have lost spouses and say, I don't know how you're doing it. I don't know how you're holding up. Humans are more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. And what I say to people who say that to me about, I could never go through what you're going through, is you would surprise yourself. I didn't think I could either. And Bonanno's research backs that up. Bonanno found that people who cope well with grief don't just feel sadness. They feel anger, sure, but they also feel relief sometimes. And here's the one that really trips people up. They laugh. Genuine laughter, real joy, showing up right alongside grief, sometimes in the same afternoon, sometimes in the same conversation. And people feel guilty about that. I hear it all the time. I laughed at my sister's joke at the funeral, and I felt terrible about it. I remember the first time I laughed or smiled or watched TV without thinking about Shayna for a couple of hours after she passed, and I felt guilty. Bonanno's research says that laughter isn't betrayal. It's not you forgetting. It's one of the tools your mind uses to keep functioning while it carries something heavy. So don't feel like when you're in grief, you've got to constantly be sad or angry or frustrated or guilty or whatever. And if you're not, you're not doing it right. You're letting that person go. You're not. He actually coined a term for this kind of coping. He calls it coping ugly. Not clean, not linear, not following anybody's 5-step outline. It's messy. It's situational. It's whatever works in that specific moment and for that specific person. Crying 1 hour, laughing the next, going numb the hour after that. And none of it means you're doing it wrong. I remember when my good friend Mike passed away just last year. It was in April. And my wife and I have a Kentucky Derby party every year, which is always the first Saturday in May, if you don't know that. And we were talking to Mike's wife about coming to the party. And she said she didn't know if she was going to be able to make it or not. And I said, you can either be miserable alone in your house right across the street. I mean, we can basically see your house from my house. You can be alone in your house, or you can be miserable with us. And she came to the party, and I saw her laughing a few times, and I saw her crying a lot of times, and we all cried. But I remember one well-meaning friend saying to her, I can't believe you went to the Smiths party only less than a month after Mike passed away. That's not understanding how grief works. So here is the line from Bonanno's work I think you need to hear most today. Grieving is not work that you have to be successful at. You're not being graded. There's no pass or fail, and you don't get to the end and find out whether you did it right. Grief work doesn't have to be grueling. There is no doing it right. But there's also the opposite side of that, is that time heals all wounds. And I don't know that that's necessarily true either. I think we have to process our grief. We have to let it flow through us, but it doesn't have to be a chore. And it doesn't have to be something that we take as a test. I also want to say this, because Bonanno talks about people being resilient and bouncing back. He's not saying that everybody bounces back easily.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So if you're struggling, that means something's wrong with you. That's not it at all. What he's found is most people are more resilient than they expect to be. And a real portion of people do struggle longer and deeper. It's just as real, it's just as documented, and it's just as valid of a path. So there is no time frame, and you should struggle for this long in this way. So when I tell you you're more resilient than you think, I'm not handing you another chart to measure yourself against. I'm telling you that the tools you're already using, even the messy ones, even the ones that don't look like what you were told grief is supposed to look like, those tools are working. They were built into you exactly for this. You might feel like if you lost this person, you wouldn't be able to go on, but you can. And I've heard so many people say to me, you don't understand, I'm not going to be able to make it. You can, you will. You are stronger than you think. Now, again, there's a meaningful minority of people who struggle longer and harder. That's not a character flaw. It's just a different trajectory, and it's not a wrong one. And I want to say this about grief counseling. I do work with people in grief as a grief guide, as a grief coach. Not everybody needs it. In fact, grief coaching or grief counseling can be actually harmful if it's something that you don't need. But it may be something that you do need. There's not a one-size-fits-all. So don't let anyone ever say to you, it's been 6 months, you should be over this by now. Or it's been 2 years, you should be ready to move on. Your grief trajectory, whatever it is the right one for you. You are never behind. You are never doing it wrong. This is so prevalent in the work that I do. People measuring themselves. Then I actually created a guided meditation. I call it A Time to Wait. And it's on my website. You can get it. You can go to grieftogrowth.com/store. So that's grieftogrowth.com/store. And you can pick up that meditation, A Time to Wait. The whole point of it is this. You know, my tagline is planted, not buried. But when you plant something, it doesn't pop out of the ground the next day. It's a process for it to grow. And my clients come to me and they're so impatient. And I understand. And they say, I feel like I'm behind. I feel like I'm stuck. I'm not moving forward. I've gone backward. You're not stuck. You're not behind. You're not moving backward. There's a time for everything under the sun, and there's actually a time to wait. There's a time to be patient, to allow whatever season you happen to be in to pass. So if grief is not a five-step line, then what is it? Well, grief doesn't move steadily forward. You've heard the old saying, we take two steps forward and one step back. It kind of applies to grief, but even that's not a good enough representation. It's more like a looping thing. You go through, you feel like you're going through a phase, and then you'll feel like you're right back where you were. And this is what I say to my clients when they tell me I'm back where I was. You're not exactly back where you were. Think of it more like a spiral. You come back to a similar place where you were in before, but you're hitting it from a higher perspective. Looking at it vertically from the top down, you might feel like you've circled around back to where you were, but you've actually taken a level up in terms of where you're coming from. There's one more model I want to give you because I think it explains something the five stages completely miss. It's called the dual process model, developed by two researchers, Margaret Stroop and Hank Schutte, back in the 1990s. And here's the idea. They said that grief isn't one process, it's two, running side by side. And healthy grieving means moving back and forth between them. The first is what they call loss orientation. And that's the part you'd expect. Crying, missing the person, looking at old photos, longing, sitting with the pain directly. The second is restoration orientation. That's you doing the dishes, going to work, learning to do the taxes your spouse used to handle, figuring out who you are now in this new phase of your life, distracting yourself sometimes on purpose because you need a break. And here's the part that matters most. Stroop and Schutte's whole point was that you're supposed to move between these two, back and forth, not stuck in loss orientation, not always grinding, not crying without relief, but also not in restoration orientation forever either, staying so busy you never actually feel it. So you're supposed to oscillate between the two. That's what healthy grieving looks like. And this is a part, again, some of my clients miss. I'll talk to them and they'll tell me, Brian, I am so tired. I've read all these books, and they'll actually bring the books out and show them to me. I've listened to like all of your podcasts. They're practicing grief like they're studying for an exam. They're practicing grief like they're going for their master's degree or like they're going for their doctorate. They're not oscillating. They're not going into that restoration orientation. They're not just taking time out, going out to dinner, going for a walk. They're not doing the restoration orientation piece of it. They're not doing the distracting themselves. Now, again, we don't want to stay in that distraction, but I've seen people do that as well. It's the back and forth that makes a grieving process that works for you. Let's think about what this means for the guilt that so many of you carry. You go to work and you forget about the loss for a while. You laugh at lunch with some friends. You make a joke. And then some part of you feels like a traitor, like you're not grieving hard enough, or you've stopped too soon. Like Lisa coming to our derby party less than a month after her husband had passed away. Well, a dual process model says the opposite. That laugh at lunch wasn't you failing to grieve. That was restoration orientation, doing exactly what it's supposed to do. So you have the strength to come back to loss orientation later when the wave hits again. Talk about people as rechargeable batteries. If we're constantly in discharge mode, if we're constantly putting out that work, doing the grind, then we don't have the energy to keep it up. That's why you feel so tired. You've got to go to the restoration orientation and recharge your battery. This ties right back into everything else we've talked about today. It's not stages. It's not a line. It's not even really a spiral by itself. It's two currents. And you're moving between them your whole life, sometimes minute by minute. Grief that only ever looks like sitting in the pain isn't healthier. Grief that only ever looks like staying busy and never feeling it isn't healthier either. It's the movement between the two that does the work. So things like anniversaries, birthdays, a certain song, a stranger's laugh that sounds like your loved one's laugh, those things can be what we call triggers. And they can trigger what's called a sudden temporary upsurge of grief, or a STUG. And I'm going to give you this warning. Again, it's not a prescription. It doesn't mean it's necessarily true for you. But the second year is sometimes harder than the first. And almost nobody warns you about that. There are some reasons why this may be the case. And I want to emphasize may be the case. In the first year, you're often in shock. Your body hasn't recovered yet. You can't handle all the things that are going on, so you put some of them off. Sometimes that second year is when things settle in and become real, become permanent. Because that first year, you're just trying to get through the first anniversary, the first birthday, the first Christmas, whatever. You get through it, and you get through that first year, and you realize, oh, I have to do this all again. So the second year, again, can't be harder than the first, but it's not true for everyone. Now, I mentioned the term STUG. Sudden temporary upsurge of grief. There's a psychologist named Therese Rando who coined this term in the early 1990s. The thing about a STUG is it can catch you off guard. It looks like this. You're fine. You're doing dishes. You're driving to work. You're standing in the supermarket aisle. Then a wave hits you with the full force of the first week for no reason you can point to. Now, sometimes you can point to it, but sometimes you just can't. It might be someone who walks by who looks like your loved one. It might be a certain song. I have a client who told me that her son's favorite time of the year was the summer, and the entire month of July became a trigger point for her the second year after her son passed away. Now, these thugs can make you feel like you've landed right back to where you were. There's a time not too long after Shayna passed, I was out. It was a beautiful summer day, my favorite time of the year. I had a song on the radio I was loving, and I was actually feeling pretty good for a moment. Then I looked up and I saw a restaurant that Shane and I used to go to together. And that brought me right back to missing her and saying, I can't stand this. I don't want to be here. All those feelings came through. That's an example of a stug that came through me. If you've lost someone, you're probably familiar with this, even if you don't know the term. Sometimes just having the terminology can be very helpful because you realize you're not alone and you're not going crazy. I'll give you another example. That first one I gave you was early after Shayna passed. This one happened just a couple of months ago, and it's been 11 years. I woke up the morning of Shayna's angelversary, June 24th, 11 years. And the first thought in my mind was Shayna's angelversary, and I don't want to do this again. I'm just exhausted. I'm tired of going through this. I felt a surge of anger. Now, it doesn't mean I went backward. It doesn't mean all 11 years of growth and the work I've done was gone. But just for that brief moment, I felt that way. I was angry at everything. Now, by the end of the day, that was gone. Here's what I find really interesting. I made a Substack post about that, about Shayna's angelversary, and that feeling I had when I woke up that morning and the arc of my day. Now, I don't usually get a whole lot of interaction on Substack, but that post circulated to over 10,000 people. So I know other people can relate to that feeling, that stug that I went through. I want you to know this, and I'm beating on this pretty hard because it's really important. A stug is not a setback. It's evidence that you love someone. It shows up uninvited, of course. Of course it's not invited, but it's not a bad thing. It's an indication of your love for them, that ongoing connection and ongoing longing. That goes back to Bonanno, the researcher I mentioned earlier. He found that people progress through grief, but it's nonlinear and it's recursive, which means it loops back on itself. That's the important thing I want you to take from his research. I want to give you one more piece here because I think it explains why stugs happen at all. For most of the 20th century, the dominant belief in psychology, going all the way back to Freud, was that healthy grieving meant cutting the bond. You were supposed to detach from the person you'd lost, grieve that detachment, and eventually reinvest that emotional energy into new relationships in the present. If you were still holding on to the relationship, still talking to them, still feeling connected, that was considered a sign you were stuck, pathological even. In 1996, three researchers, Dennis Klass, Phil Silverman, and Steven Nickman, published a book that challenged that entire model. It's called Continuing Bonds. And what they found studying widows, bereaved parents, bereaved children, was the healthiest people weren't the ones who cut the cord. They were the ones who found a way to stay connected. The relationship didn't end, it changed shape. This is exactly why I talk about Shayna the way I do. Present tense. She loves penguins, not she loved penguins. And that's not a grammar choice. That's continuing bonds. I didn't know the academic term for it, but that's what continuing bonds is. And people are still talking about this old Freudian notion. Shayna passed 11 years ago. My first grief counselor told me to speak about her plainly, to use the word dead, to understand that the relationship basically was over. And I pushed back against that. I knew somewhere in my heart that wasn't right. And I'm glad when I went through my grief education that I found this thing of continuing bonds that validates what I already knew and I was going to hold on to anyway. So the relationship didn't end when she passed. It changed. Now, I was going to say I don't get new memories with her, but I actually kind of do. I've talked about some of the miraculous signs I've gotten from Shayna here and in other places. I still get connection with her. I still have a relationship with her memory, though, with her presence in my life, what she taught me, and what she still teaches me. So when a stug hits you out of nowhere, that's not a broken bond trying to reassert itself. It's not you going backwards. It's not pathological. That's a continuing bond doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's the relationship still alive, showing up to remind you that it's still there. You're not supposed to sever that connection. You're supposed to learn how to carry it.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Let's talk about something else, because you can be completely fine at 10 o'clock in the morning and then be undone by 10:15. And it really has nothing to do with stages. So let's talk about internal family systems. This was created by a man named Richard Swartz, and I'm going to reference it here. I don't have time to teach it, but I'm going to give you in plain speech, so you can understand it at least as much as I understand it. You're not a single self reacting to grief. You know, we all have internal voices, or at least almost everybody does. There's this running dialogue that we have with ourselves, a voice telling us that maybe we're not good enough, or this person did that to us, and this is why they're doing it and what they're going through. If you're hearing something in your head that's not you, that's what Richard Swartz calls a part. And we react to things with these parts. These parts are formed when events happen to us, and that part kind of gets stuck in time. There's a part of you that's still standing exactly where the loss happened. There's a part that's trying to protect you from feeling any of it at all. Now, Swartz calls these managers, firefighters, and exiles. And we don't have to go through the whole terminology. But the thing is, we have these parts working to do different things. So the useful question, I think, is this. When a wave hits, when a stug hits, how do I feel toward the part of me that's bringing this up? And when you become curious and when you become compassionate, that's when you're coming from your core self, not from one of your parts. If you're feeling anger, shame, guilt, or the urge to shut it down fast, that means another part just grabbed the wheel. Swartz wrote a book called No Bad Parts. Now, this is the thing that I say about emotions, about parts, and about in positive intelligence, what we call saboteurs. Wherever you want to call these things, I want to say there are no bad emotions. I'd say also with Swartz, there are no bad parts. They're all there to do a job. Our job as our core self, our higher self, or whatever you want to call it, is to become curious, to become compassionate, and ask these parts, what are you here to teach us? What are you trying to say? And if it's a feeling we don't want to hold on to, like say anger or shame or guilt, we want to calm that part. And let that anger, that shame, that guilt, let it go. Now, none of your parts are the problem. The part of me that still goes back to that morning, that moment when I found Shana in her bed, unresponsive, that part is not broken. It's just holding on to something nobody told it was safe to put down. So let me walk you through what this actually looks like, because it's easy to hear this as a theory and not know what to do with it in the moment. So say you're at a stoplight. A song comes on the radio that she used to sing along to, and suddenly you can't breathe, and you're gripping the wheel, and there's this hot wave of something, maybe your anger, maybe just raw grief, and it's coming up fast. In the old five stages way of thinking, you might tell yourself, I thought I was past this. What's wrong with me? That's judgment. That's fighting the part. Here's the parts way of doing it instead. You notice the wave, and instead of judging it, you get curious. You literally ask silently, what's happening right now? What just showed up in me? And you wait. Not for an answer in words, necessarily, just for a sense of it. Sometimes what you'll notice is that it's a very young part of you. It's a part that's still standing in the moment you got the news. And that part just heard something that reminded it of her. And it did what it always does. It surged forward to make sure you didn't forget. And then this is the part people skip. You thank that part. Not necessarily out loud, but internally. Something like, I see you. I know why you're here. I'm not going anywhere. You can ease up now. I've got the wheel. That's it. That's the whole practice. You treat that part like a small child and you just encourage it. You're not fighting the wave down. You're not pretending it's not there. You're meeting it like you'd meet a scared kid who ran into the room, not like an enemy who broke down your door. That's the difference between bracing against a stug and moving through one. Bracing says, go away. I don't have time for this. I don't like this. Curiosity says, I hear you, and I'm still here too. Hopefully that difference is clear to you. We all have these parts. When I tell people we're going to work with our parts, we're going to integrate our parts, the one thing I don't want them to do is to fight their parts. It's not a battle. They are not your enemy. They are not here to harm you. They're trying to keep you safe. They're trying to protect you. That's really important as we go through this work. So if there is no map, what do you do instead? Now, I've studied some of these maps and theories and methodologies, and they're all interesting. They all have their role. But what I find really, really important, what I want you to remember, is do not grade yourself against a chart that was never about you. In fact, you know, we have these maps. What think about maps is they're static. They don't change. Think of it more like if you have a GPS that changes as circumstances change. When a stug hits, when a sudden temporary upsurge in grief hits, don't fight it. Let the wave pass through you instead of bracing against it. If you fight it, it tends to make it last longer. I used to have panic attacks, and I would fight them because they feel horrible. You feel like you're dying. And what I realized is the more I fought against them, the longer they lasted, and actually the more intense they got. So what I had to learn to do was to relax through it, to let it go through me. When a part is activating you, triggering you, making you feel a stug, ask yourself, how do I feel about this part? Meet it with curiosity instead of with panic. Then maybe tell someone what actually happened instead of just saying, I'm fine. Grief that's witnessed moves through you much more easily than grief that's hidden. When I was hiding my panic attack back in the days, I really, really struggled with it. But once I started talking to people about them, my counselor, my wife, trusted people, they got better. They eased up. And I could even tell people when I was having one and I got through it. For me, on Shano's Angelversary, when I wrote about it the next day, I wrote about the great parts of the day too. The time I spent with my wife, my daughter Kayla, and her fiance. We went out for pizza. We had a sign from Shana. She loved penguins, and we had this stuffed penguin as a sign from her. And I told all of that, but I also told the part about the stug I experienced that morning. And that note I put on Substack got more hits, views, likes, whatever, than any other note I've written by many times over. And I think what really resonated with people wasn't just the great part of the day, but it was that stug I was honest about in the morning. I could have said, I'm doing fine. I'm doing great. This is a great angelversary I had, but I still have these stugs. And that was part of the day too. Now it's becoming a smaller and smaller part of the day. They don't come and stay the way they used to, but it's still there sometimes. Let me get specific with you because I think this is where it actually becomes useful instead of just something that you nod along to. Say Mother's Day is coming up and you lost a child. That date is loaded a month before it even arrives. Don't wait for it to ambush you. Sit down the week before and actually decide what that day is going to look like. Do you want to be around family or do you want space? Do you want somebody to say her name out loud or does that undo you this year? Decide in advance and tell the people around you what you decided so that they're not guessing either. Say it's a wedding anniversary and you lost a spouse. Some people want to mark that date. They want to go to the restaurant, order what they always order. Some people want to get out of town entirely that week. And both are right. Only you know what's right for you. What's not right is waking up at 7 in the morning with no plan and no one around you who knows what you need. Say it's the first Christmas, the one that comes with an audience, extended family. There may be traditions that suddenly feel unbearable, or they may suddenly feel like they're the only thing holding you together. Give yourself permission out loud to leave early if you need to. This is a strategy I employed. Tell one person in the room ahead of time so you're not making that decision alone in the moment in front of everybody. You're not trying to avoid the feeling. You can't and you shouldn't try. These days are going to come. What you're doing is you're refusing to let it catch you flat-footed. There's a difference between bracing for pain and preparing for it. Bracing is dread. Preparing is care. One more thing before I move on, because it's not just you doing this to yourself. Sometimes it's the people around you, and they mean well. Somebody in your life is going to say at some point, isn't it time you move past this? Or you seem stuck. Or the one that gets me every time, well, at least you got closure. They're not trying to hurt you. Most of the time, they're uncomfortable with grief they can't fix. And the 5-stage story gives them a timeline that they can hold on to. They're still holding on to that old 5 stages of grief thing. If they believe there's an endpoint, an acceptance stage, a place where you arrive and then you're done, then your ongoing grief starts to look to them like something's gone wrong instead of something that's simply still happening. So here's what I want to give you for that moment, because it's going to come. You don't owe anyone a defense of your timeline. You can simply say, this is just what grief looks like for me right now. You don't have to teach them about Bonanno or Stugs or continuing bonds, standing in someone's kitchen at a family gathering. You can just hold the line gently. This is what it looks like for me right now. That's a complete sentence. It doesn't need their agreement to be true. Now you might think, for me, it's been 11 years, Brian. Shayna was 15 when she passed. She's been gone 2/3 as long as the time that she was actually here. The waves should be less. In fact, they should be gone. I want to say this to you about the waves. They do get less. There are fewer and fewer of them. They're spread farther apart. They're actually easier to anticipate, and they're not as big. All of that is true. But it doesn't mean they're absolutely 100% gone. And I don't know that they ever will be. So when that happens to me, I don't feel like, oh, it's over, or I've gone backwards, or all the work I've done is worthless and out the door. Not at all. I feel like this is where I'm supposed to be. This is what grief looks like for me right now. Before I close today, I want to answer a few things I hear a lot, because I think some of you are sitting there with a version of your grief that doesn't match anything I've described today. And I don't want you to feel left out of this conversation. The first one, what if I never got angry at all? I hear this constantly. Someone will tell me, everybody talks about the anger stage, and I just never had it. And I've had people tell me they haven't had it. They went straight to this heavy, quiet sadness and stayed there. Does that mean there's something wrong with me? No. Remember, none of this was ever a checklist to begin with. Some people's grief runs hot. Some people's grief runs low and slow and heavy. Neither one is more correct. Anger is not a required step on some itinerary. It's one possible response among many. And plenty of people who love deeply never feel it at all. The second one, and this is a big one, what if my grief doesn't even count? I have people come to me grieving an ex-spouse they haven't been married to in a decade. Grieving a friend when everyone around them says, well, you weren't family. Grieving a miscarriage that nobody else in their life even knew happened. Grieving a pet they lost like a child and getting told it was just a dog. There's a term for this. It's called disenfranchised grief. Grief is not measured by the world's permission. is measured by the size of the bond. If that relationship mattered to you, your grief is real, whether anyone else in your life understands it or not. You don't need a certificate, a title, or a wedding ring to justify what you're feeling. And the third one, what if I feel relieved and that relief makes me feel like a monster? This comes up more than you think, especially after a long illness or after a relationship that was complicated or abusive or exhausting in ways nobody outside of it understood. Somebody passes, and underneath the grief, there's this quiet, guilty sense of, thank God that's over. And then the shame about feeling that hits twice as hard as the grief itself. Now remember what Bonanno found. Relief is one of the inborn emotions that shows up right alongside grief. It doesn't cancel out love, and it doesn't mean you're a terrible person. It usually means the relationship or the illness or the caregiving was every bit as hard as it felt. Relief and grief can occupy the exact same body at the exact same time. They're not a contradiction. This is just what it means to be a complicated human being who loved in a complicated situation. And one more, because I think this might be the one hiding underneath a lot of the others. What if part of me doesn't want the pain to go away because I'm scared that if it fades, it means I'm letting go of them? I hear versions of this all the time, usually from people who are actually doing better and feel guilty about it. If the waves get smaller, if the stugs get farther apart, if a whole week goes by without that heaviness, some part of them panics, like the pain was a last thread connecting them to their person. And if the thread frays, the person disappears a second time. I want to be really direct with you about this. Connection was never the pain. The pain is just what love feels like when it feels like it has nowhere to go in this moment, in this body, missing someone who isn't here to receive it. But the bond itself is the actual relationship, that continuing bond we talked about earlier. It doesn't run on pain. It runs on memory, on presence, on the way they shaped you, on the ways you still talk to them, still feel them, still carry them forward in who you're becoming. That doesn't fade when the pain fades. If anything, it gets clearer because it's no longer buried under the acute part. And I tell you this from experience, because I felt this myself, that if I let the pain go, if I didn't keep the wound open, I would lose the love. And I can tell you that's not true. That's the point of today's episode. Whatever you're feeling in your grief, I want you to understand it's okay. Wherever you are in your grief journey, you're where you need to be. There's no one particular model of grief. There's no one particular type of grief. There's no one feeling that you should have or a set of five feelings that you should have. So take that for what it's worth, and I hope this helps. But I'm not going to leave you here. This week we talked about what it's like going through the grief. Next week we're going to talk about where you could possibly go from here. You can find more of my work at grieftogrowth.com, on the podcast, and on my Substack, grieftogrowth.substack.com. That's always grief, the numeral 2, growth. And if today hit close to home, if you've been rushing yourself, trying to hurry through this because you think you should be further along by now, go check out A Time to Wait, my guided meditation. That's at grieftogrowth.com/store. Until next time, this is Brian Smith. Have a great day. Thank you for spending this time with me on After the Storm. If today's conversation resonated with you, I'd love to continue the journey together. You can find more of my work at www.grieftogrowth.com. That's grief, G-R-I-E-F, the numeral 2, growth.com. Until next week, remember, after the storm is where the healing begins.